prayer were made of sound, the skies over England that night would have deafened the world. Captains paced their decks. Pilots tapped their gauges. Commanders pored over maps, fully aware that for all the months of meticulous planning, everything could go wrong. The winds, the tides, the element of surprise, and above all, the audacious bet that what waited on the other side of the channel would compel men not to shrink away, but to charge ahead.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we begin today at the American Cemetery at Omaha Beach in France, where President Obama and French President François Hollande stood alongside veterans to mark the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Of course, the anniversary comes at a time of renewed tension between old allies in Europe. But in the early summer sunshine, leaders of the United States, Canada, Europe, and Russia put aside their differences to honor the moment when their predecessors joined forces to liberate a continent from tyranny.
We don't just honor sacrifice, as grateful as the world is. We come to remember why America and our allies gave so much for the survival of liberty at this moment of maximum peril. We come to tell the story of the men and women who did it so that it remains seared into the memory of a future world.
President Obama there, and we'll take you back to Normandy later this hour, and we'll hear some sound of some people who were there as the world pauses today to remember. Of course, after 70 years, firsthand accounts of the events of D-Day continue to slip away from our collective national memory. Of the 16 million Americans who served their country in the Second World War, just over a million remain today. Many of their stories have never been told. Young men returning home in the middle of the 20th century largely fell silent about their experiences of war. But decades later, a lot of that changed for the men of Easy Company. That's the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division. The landing at Normandy was just one battle of many that the company fought across Europe during World War II. And historian Stephen Ambrose documented their story in his 1992 book, Band of Brothers. And it was screenwriter Eric Jenderson, along with Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, who transformed that book into what became one of the most acclaimed HBO miniseries of all time.
Standing in the door, I could see the lights on a drop zone way in the, ahead of us. We had the red light, had everybody standing up, ready to jump. So when the plane started to get hit, and suddenly the pilot gives me the green light, I'm out the door immediately.
That's Easy Company paratrooper Major Richard Winters, one of the main characters of the television show as well, recalling the moments before he jumped from his plane to the beaches of Normandy on this day 70 years ago. Eric Jenderson, lead writer and supervising producer for Band of Brothers, began his years-long mission to tell the story of Easy Company by sitting down with the then-living Winters in his Pennsylvania home. It was the first of hundreds of conversations they would have.
The first step from my job as lead writer and supervising producer was to assemble everything and to craft what's called a Bible for the series. And in order to do that, my first stop was in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where I met Major Richard Winters.
My hometown, as a matter of fact.
Seriously?
Yes.
Well, that's a coincidence. Well, this is where Winters had retired. We met, and it was the beginning of an extraordinary friendship. Genuinely a sort of a life-changing friendship, I think, for both of us in a lot of ways. Subsequently, over the course of the next 3 years, there was scarcely a day that we didn't speak. But when I went to Hershey, I went up to his office upstairs in his little house. And the very first thing he did was he shoved a piece of paper across the table toward me. It was a letter from the daughter of one of the members of Easy Company, because unfortunately, Stephen Ambrose had made a mistake in his book. And he had identified this particular soldier as somebody who had disobeyed a direct order during the Battle of the Bulge. And it had destroyed him when the book came out. He was just absolutely distraught. And Winters was still the commanding officer of this company, without question. even in retirement. And so this particular soldier's daughter had written to him an appeal. Is there anything you could do to help? And Winters simply slid this letter across his desk toward me and watched me read it. And he wanted to see what my reaction would be. And I said, well, I guess the first order of business is going to be to correct this. Mm-hmm. The materials that Richard Winters handed over to me on that day in Hershey, when I actually stacked them up at my home and measured them, it was a 6-foot-high pile of paperwork. Mm-hmm. There were S2 reports and intelligence reports and journal entries and letters. And my initial job was to go through all of that material and sort of start from scratch and recreate day by day, moment by moment, exactly what had happened from the time most of these guys arrived in Toccoa to the moment when the war ended.
You know, Eric Jenerson, one of the things that sort of happens sometimes in the writing of war history or making of programs about war history is a tendency to deify the soldiers and the officers and the people involved in the story. And I was struck always with the fact that you didn't really do that. Of course, there is a lot of heroism and that's portrayed, but there's also a lot of reality of war, shooting of prisoners and horrible things that went on that don't deify what is the Greatest Generation.
It's a great question. If there was any guiding principle or phenomena that came out of the creation of this series, creatively, everyone involved, and particularly the writers, were so dedicated to serving the story of these guys. And to answer your question, the reason why no one is deified and we stuck so close, assiduously, to the truth was because these gentlemen themselves, these veterans, these members of Easy Company, would never have stood for it. And we were trying to serve their experience. These are guys who famously, I mean, if anybody is talking about the Battle of the Bulge and how it was, you know, there was 3 feet of snow or the snow was up to your knees, they'd say, no, it wasn't. It was about 18 inches. Mm.
Well, let's hear from another one of the members of Easy Company. This is Bill Maynard, who was also a paratrooper who jumped into Normandy.
In the back of your mind, you wonder what's going to happen and all that. You know, you've been trained and trained and trained and what your job is going to be and what you're supposed to do. And that's what you got to think about, you know. And we lost a lot of people that night. But you try to put it all out of your mind.
It can be a little bit difficult when you're watching the young men portrayed by the actors in battle, talking to each other, smoking cigarettes and being young men, connecting them to the real old men who speak for real in Band of Brothers.
The show aired in 2001. And Saving Private Ryan had come out, I guess, 2 years prior and had sort of cracked open a door for a lot of old gentlemen of that Greatest Generation. The men who came back from World War II, these sons of the Depression, who knew that their relatives, their mothers, their fathers, their aunts and uncles, had no frame of reference for understanding what their experience had been. So they were unable to articulate it. And so almost to a man, the vast majority of these gentlemen, all suffering from various forms of combat trauma without question, they just fell silent. And many families had no idea that their grandfather or their father had participated in this grand event. And Saving Private Ryan kind of cracked open the door and Band of Brothers sort of kicked it open. And what happened as a result was most of these gentlemen who were in their early 80s, late 70s, early 80s at that time, were able, for the first time in many cases, to point to that and say, okay, you see that? Let me explain what I had to do with it. Mm-hmm. And it changed families because it gave them something. It gave them a way to talk about it.
Memory, of course, is always plastic. It's never perfect. And over the years, it gets worse and worse, even when the events are so very vivid. Did you have any concerns with the vets that you were talking about, that their detailed stories were, in fact, accurate rather than just sort of watercolored impressions?
I didn't. It's a great question. And I had never really thought about that. But in retrospect, it was astonishing how accurate these gentlemen were in terms of their memory. And I know that for a fact because I was constantly cross-referencing stories with the point of view of somebody else who was there at the same time. And it was pretty amazing. Unfortunately, I think I should also point out that in the case of these gentlemen, I'm not sure that there wasn't a single one of them who wasn't in some way suffering from the effects of combat and what that does to your memory. they dealt with it, and some of them, the few remaining gentlemen, still do deal with it in ways that are different from how we are attempting to, you know, address this problem of what we call PTSD. But for so many of these men, the memories lived and continued to live with them, and they were very, very present. They never really went away. So those memories were so vivid still because they were traumatic. And, you know, there's always this attempt to make sense of what you have experienced, and in every sense, from the moment their Corcorans hit the soil in Normandy to the end of the war, what they experienced was highly unusual and highly traumatic. The single event that almost none of them wished to speak of, and they did everything to avoid speaking of it, was the discovery of the prison camp at Landsberg. Because, again, for them, they had no frame of reference for all of these men and women who'd been rounded up and were being held for no other reason than they were Jews or gypsies. They couldn't understand that. There was no frame of reference for that. And it scared them. And it bothered them so deeply. With all of the tragedies and the traumas that they'd experienced and everything they'd witnessed, that was the one thing that they still were completely unable to digest.
We're now in 2014 on the tail end of two wars that were, in fact, longer than World War II, much less bloody, of course. What's the legacy, do you think, now of all these soldiers and officers, veterans that you talk to? When you view it in the context of the wars that the United States has spent the last 12 or 13 years enduring?
It's a complex thing. I think that the lesson of leadership, the lessons of strength of character and toughness, but principally the notion of follow me, that the greatest generation learned and the way they executed themselves in World War II, to some extent has been an inspiration for soldiers to join up. It's been a recruiting tool, unfortunately, because I don't think any of these vets would look at what's happening right now, the way in which our military is trained and how they're deployed with an approving eye. And so there's a tremendous irony to that, that it caused more young men and women to want to join up and to experience the hell that is war.
Eric Jenderson was lead writer and supervising producer for the acclaimed HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, came out in 2001. He began research on it as far back as 1998. Eric Jenderson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Todd.
June 6, 1944, and the greatest armada in military history is assembled in England for an assault on Hitler's fortress Europe, all under the supreme command of General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
It came at a cost. An estimated 9,000 Allied soldiers died on that day, and carnage from the campaign extended far beyond the coast, deep into the French countryside. Major General Norman D. Cotta, who was heavily involved in the planning of D-Day, recalls his soldiers' commitment to the campaign.
The great thing about this landing was that these men knew what their mission was, what they were to do. And they knew that regardless of what they ran into, they were to carry on, even down to the last man.
Peter Thomas served with the 1st Infantry Division, and he recalls the efforts of those brave men in a poem called Omaha Beach.
When we went in, the beach had been taken. The living fought on, the dead forsaken. We were dropped into water up to our shoulders. We waded in. A group of green soldiers onto that thin strip of beach so many had tried to reach.
And we should note that after the war, Thomas went on to have a long career as a radio and TV announcer. He settled in Florida. He married. He had three kids. But the experience of that day stays with him. We thank him and all those who continue to serve. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.